Welcome to the Alien Wellness Think Tank podcast series. The Think Tank is an emergency medicine organization led by residents for residents to improve the culture of wellness during residency training. Take a listen to our conversations with our wellness strategists and mentors.
Welcome. My name is Tanner. I am one of the resident leaders here at the Think Tank, and tonight I am joined by Michelle Lynn and some of our great residents from the Think Tank themselves. And tonight we're here to actually sit down and chat with the one and only Z-Dog MD. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, sir. So before we kind of kick off on the questions here, you're such a unique person. You've carved this amazing niche for yourself in both the rap world and medicine. And how did you end up where you're at?
What's funny is you just said the rap world and then medicine in the same breath, which, you know, that's a, just already. It's just, you know, thank you. It's really an honor to be here with people who are actually doing stuff and are smart. And I'm just like kind of smoke and mirrors at this point. But I would say that, you know, for me, it was just about having a voice again for physicians and for providers in general to say, you know what, we need a unique way to kind of not just complain, but come up with solutions for our problems, not just to, you know, physician wellness, patient wellness, all those pieces together and trying to see if we can do something to make the system better.
My name is Judah. I'm one of the second year residents at Drexel. Thanks again for having us here. So I guess in terms of my question, just in terms of wellness is, you know, around this time of year, it starts getting cold. A lot of residents kind of hit their, especially interns hit their, I guess the peak of their frustration around this time. Do you have any recommendations as to how to identify, you know, some of these residents and any advice as to what we should say or do for these residents?
I think you're exactly right. And I think point two, it's getting cold. And not only that, but the light is changing. And we ignore the effect of solar radiation to our peril on our sense of well-being. And, you know, we start out in the summer and yes, it's slower and there's less flu and there's less of all of that, less volume, but also there's a lot of sun in those places. First of all, being aware that this is a transit time that people are entering this sort of long dark night of the soul, especially when they're interns or second year residents and they're working really hard, and having the feelers open to people's state of mood. And the problem is there's a suck it up attitude in medicine where we don't actually admit when we're suffering, or we do it in these weird, oblique, passive aggressive roundabout ways, like, I don't know, making jokes on rounds, or, you know, just not showing up and taking a mental health day, or there's a million different things that could happen. I think that's a millennial thing, the mental health day. So, you know, from an attending standpoint, just being aware of it, but from a resident standpoint, supporting each other, which is hard because we don't talk about these things. It's a bit of a taboo, actually. Suck it up, do your thing. And I think that was more the case too in my generation, where it was like, you know, weren't really work hour rules and that sort of thing. And we just had to plow through, and it was brutal. And we had a ton of depression and people crashing their cars due to sleep deprivation and all of that. So hopefully those days are evolving out.
Well, that sort of goes along with my question too, is I think we see a lot of burnout and depression in residents, and they're not seeking help until they're at the point of crisis. So sort of what would your thoughts be to address it before they get to that point and to encourage people to seek help?
I mean, what you said is basically the encouraging people to seek help part is really a crucial piece of the culture of how we train. And I think part of the biggest problem, especially when I was training, is that, you know, we don't communicate with each other as house staff in terms of how hard we're taking this. And this culture of not being open with each other then translates up in through the ranks so that the attendings can't really read what's going on. They're busy. And nowadays it's even worse because the attendings are taking so much of the workload because of work hour rules and things. So that this is spread out. Now it's no longer the deal where, you know, the attending is, oh man, just work hard, kiss the ring, and one day you'll be the ring that's kissed. It's all good. It's not like that anymore. Work hard, suffer, be burned out, and then can lather, rinse, repeat as an attending. So to me, it's a very complicated answer to start just with your piece, making it okay, making it safe to talk about these things to begin with, trying to demystify some of the nonsense around mindfulness and all this other stuff that people talk about that are catches. But in practice, you're going to find 15 minutes even a day in your busy schedule where your mind's racing to sit and, you know, try to perspectivize it through mindfulness. It's very hard. You need tools and support to do that. You need a group to actually hold you accountable and maybe even go on a retreat as part of like something that's paid for by residency to actually get the tools to do that. It's not easy. It's not a magic answer. And then on top of that, You need to feel like you're connected to something bigger than yourself. And the problem is that's exactly what residency is designed to not do. You are there to categorize, compartmentalize, analyze, get through your day, get through your scut list, and the big picture will elude you. And in the process of that, you're robbed of your meaning. And that's what really provides the support when you're getting ready to be burned out. So trying to bring some of those things back, even if it involves, like, you know, something daily that we do where we just sit and go, let's be thankful for the fact that we get to be with patients when they're absolutely vulnerable every single day. And that's a gift. And that's what we do, and re-inspire us to then get through this horrible, you know, workload and everything else. So again, I don't have a magic answer, but it's a bigger picture. The way I did it, actually, and not to ramble more, but it was an attitudinal adjustment. So I tried to look at residency as this kind of process of, it was fun. Like, I tried to find the fun in even the most miserable things. And the way you do that is you look to other people on the team and you say, we're going to have a good time. We're going to create these characters. We're going to sing songs. We're going to do things. And that's one thing that's very much missing in residency, in medicine culture in general, right, is this idea that you can actually have fun while still being professional, still taking care of patients. And so trying to bring that into it. And your liver rounds is great. You know, I don't know if you guys still have those, or where you just go and get drunk with your colleagues. That's not a sustainable algorithm, right? It's like a little glit. The thing is, how do you bring a little of that live arounds culture, minus the alcohol, onto the wards and bring that culture along with you? So that's kind of how we got through. And I'm not saying it was easy, but it did help a lot.
I really like what you said about making it a part of our getting it out there and talking about it. I'm chief resident this year, and I thought that I was going to have all these interns and second years come to me with their problems. And they don't, because they don't want to feel weak or unsupported. And so they hold it inside, and you have to find it and pull it out of them. And so I think that's a really big thing, is getting that culture switch.
You absolutely nailed it. And the truth is, like, I still wonder if people come out and say, look, I'm having a hard time with depression. I'm feeling like I don't have a purpose. I'm wondering if I made a mistake. How are they judged by their superiors and their peers, who feel like, you know, sometimes they're projecting a little bit of their own feelings of inadequacy and failure and burnout. And they're saying, oh, look at this guy, or gal, she can't, or he can't handle this. And so there is that concern. It is a kind of the vestiges of this militaristic kind of suck it up culture. So you're right. I mean, I could see why people would be nervous to come to you, even though you have an adorable beard and people want to be a part of that. You know, it still is, it's relatively, there's a high activation energy to make that happen.
You know, we have the same problem in our program. I'm one of the third years at Boston Medical Center, and we found that people just aren't asking for help until it's too late. And I've been trying to develop more of a peer support program to encourage people to just go to other residents that have volunteered to be supporters. But the culture shift, I think, is the most challenging thing to get past.
I think you're right, and I think that culture begins in medical school. So I don't know about how y'all trained, but at UCSF, sorry, Michelle, like, I found it was really interesting. We were all these, you know, cream of the crop kids who were like, rah! But then throw you pass fail the first 2 years. Everyone's like undercover gunner doing their thing. But this hyper-competitive streak that we have doesn't disappear like that. And it reemerges when the honors came back on the wards. And what we found is, you know, everyone denies to everyone else they're having a hard time. And then at the very end, in the fourth year, we had this party where everyone hung out. And man, were you really depressed third year? Everyone had already matched. The pressure was off. Yeah, I was totally depressed. I've never been that depressed in my life. I was like borderline suicidal. What happened? Oh man, was it OB? No, it was just being put in the hospital and not knowing what you're doing and having all these demands on you. And everybody opened up in this incredible way, and people were crying and stuff. And I'm like, where were these people for the 4 years that we needed them to be open and vulnerable with each other? It's only in the end when they're already done. And then they go into residency and it clamps back down again, right? So it's a culture thing. It's an expectation thing. Actually, I think I'm very encouraged that the millennial generation is a lot more open and you know, say, and believe me, I'm Gen X. We will rag on you nonstop because it's what we do. And I think partially it's out of jealousy, because I think you guys have found certain formulas that do work for personal fulfillment versus being a part of the matrix all the time.
So you talk a lot about how important this culture shift is. And I think that especially amongst a group like this, there are definitely people who start talking about wanting to affect change. But I think especially as residents, not necessarily as attendings or program directors, what are things that you think we can do to try to change the culture of medicine, whether it's even starting within our programs?
You mean as residents, what can you do?
Yeah, that's hard. As residents, we just...
Yeah.
I feel a little powerless. I feel a little powerless.
I'm going to be honest. Just seeing you guys on this hangout to me is inspiring because you guys are taking the initiative to stand up and say, oh, we should probably be doing something about resident wellness instead of just sitting around and complaining and maybe bitching at administration and so on, because that we're real good at that. But we're not so good at coming up with actionable solutions with our peers too. You know what would be really cool? And again, I'm about 4 years removed from the direct academic medical experience, but I had about 12 years experience in it, as an attending or attending-ish for that time. You know, the idea that you guys actually take the initiative and do sort of peer groups. Now, I heard someone mention earlier about starting these peer sort of groups. Now, the problem is, one of the problems here with this culture is that we are the most cynical, I mean, as physicians, right? We're hyper-cynical. So someone says, we're going to do a peer group thing where we're going to work out some of our burnout issues and focus on wellness. Everyone's like, yeah, you are. Sure, whatever, that's going to happen. Or, you know, oh, I'm going to have to sit and do a kumbaya thing. And so there's a lot of skepticism, right? So how do you get people along for these things? And I think, you know, some of the simplest things are just maybe even folding it into activities you would normally do, like resident rapport, journal club, things like that, and saying, okay, you know what, we're going to do a stress psychology journal club or resident report where we talk about the latest psychology on how humans actually handle stress and burnout and things like that and how they are looking for meaning, connectedness, and relations. And also one other thing to remember is that humans are hardwired for, and if you read any of Jonathan Haidt's work, Happiness Hypothesis, The Righteous Mind, he's a psychologist. His conclusion is that we're really hypersocial creatures wired for relational hierarchies. So in other words, we care what our peers and other people think of us and are standing in that social group, since we're not related by genetics, it's more a group dynamic, is a life or death scenario for us. So understanding that in resident groups where what our peers think, like if we're the slacker who's always dumping patients, right? That is a reputation you don't want to have. If you're the guy who's depressed and can't hack it, that's a reputation, that a perception that you don't want. So how do we address that point blank and say, who's having trouble here? And knowing that everybody is on the same page or a similar page, being open and saying that, then creates a group dynamic where it's okay to express those things. You're not going to damage your relations with the group. You're not going to damage your reputation or your social standing. And these are perceptual. I'm not saying they're real things. I'm saying they're perceptual things. And our human brain is wired for that. One quick thing I'll say is part of the reason humans have stage fright, there is a fight or flight response that happens when you get on stage because you actually think you could lose your life. In other words, it's an existential crisis for you because your reputation with the group matters so much in hypersocial human tribes and groups that it is equivalent to being chased after with a knife. You're putting your reputation on the line. And I think it's very similar in creating cultural groups in residency. We're very afraid that we're going to look like that guy. And even though we say we don't care what we think, all the data shows we do. And they've done tests where actually people do care what other people think, even when they deny it, and actually especially when they deny it. So coming up with solutions around that social dynamic in a residency program where the goal is to try to look tough and get through and suck it up and help your friends, it is a huge barrier that we need to try to work on.
I have a question. Like, one of the reasons we all get into this is to like help make people feel good, and we feel good doing that. So like, what do you say or what do you recommend we tell our patients in the emergency department to get their wellness like up to par, and that'll therefore help our wellness? Do you have any like stories or catchphrases that you would use?
Man, I mean, this is a crucial piece, and it gets to, you know, I was just talking to a nurse today who was talking about this idea of compassion fatigue and how we quickly saturate and are unable to we get very emotionally detached from our patients. We're trying to make them feel good. And so I want to clarify a couple things. I want to distinguish between empathy and compassion. And they're often conflated, right? But they're really not the same. Empathy is putting yourself in someone else's shoes and feeling their pain and reacting based on that experience. Now, what you're describing about wanting to make patients feel good, I think, if I'm interpreting correct, is our desire through empathy, through feeling, okay, someone's suffering, I feel that. Oh, if I were like that, I would want to do this. And you want to make them feel better. Now, the problem with empathy is a couple fold. And there have been articles written on this by psychologists that are kind of pushing the boundaries of this stuff. And they have titles like, you know, the reason empathy is horrible, or, you know, empathy is a bad idea, which immediately, right, we all just go, like, I thought that's why we do what we do. But let me just clarify. So empathy, when you really feel someone else's pain, let's say someone who's addicted to narcotics and they're coming in trying to manipulate you for drugs in the ER, and you just want them to feel better because they're clearly withdrawing, they're suffering, and you're first instinct, how do I make them feel better? Well, let me just give them a little bit of Dilaudid, and later it'll be okay, and so on and such. Now, what you're doing is a disservice. And the same goes in the criminal justice system. If you empathize with either the victim or the alleged criminal, you're going to behave in a way that is not necessarily as rational or as compassionate as it might be were you not influenced by this sort of putting yourself in their shoes. So empathy is one thing, and it's very fatiguing, and it makes for bad decisions a lot of times. You need it, particularly with your immediate family, and you need it sometimes when you're about to do a procedure on someone and you realize, man, this is going to hurt, how would I try to minimize the suffering here? But compassion is very different. Compassion is love in the face of suffering. So you first of all have to have enough empathy to recognize suffering, and then have enough of the tools to want the well-being of that patient, to love them enough that you want them to actually get better. And this is a little different than wanting them to feel good. It's more wishing them, as a conscious member of this tribe of humanity, well-being, the best that they can have with the least suffering. And that can be cultivated. That can be actually taught to a degree, and it can be felt viscerally, and it is not fatiguing when you practice it. So Buddhist monks practice a kind of meditation called metta, which is compassion meditation, where they actively wish well on first their friends, then people they barely know, then their enemies as they get good at it. And then when you can love your enemy with unbounded compassion, you can go into the emergency department with the worst, most manipulative drug seeker who's just making everyone's life miserable, and see their suffering as a human being and love them while doing the tough thing, right? Which is doing the right thing medically. And that's the challenge that takes a lot of practice and wisdom, but it also takes some teaching, which I don't think we necessarily provide our house staff, because we say, yeah, be empathic. And then people are burned out, and they're building up walls to stop feeling everyone's pain, because it's overwhelming. My first month on oncology at Stanford, I built a wall around myself that it took years to undo, because seeing young people die of cancer and suffering and seeing their families, I couldn't feel that without becoming incapacitated. The first time I became incapacitated, I felt totally weak, and I felt like my reputation was on the line, all those things I was talking about, and I built a wall and I stopped feeling it, right? So that's not the way to survive, right? The way to survive is to translate that into compassion. It's very hard to do, but I think that's part of it. And that was a very long answer to your very simple question. I apologize.
Kind of playing off your kind of personal story there, how did you break down those walls? I know you said it took years, but what did you do to break down those walls?
The reason I'm again, really honored that you asked me to come talk about this is that I was the perpetrator of a lot of this problem for a lot of my career. I mean, as an attending physician, as a resident, the way that I coped with empathy fatigue and this sort of kind of burnout, if you will, was to use humor as a coping mechanism, but not as a very advanced coping mechanism, as a mechanism to build a wall. So if you are if you're deep down feeling like not unconnected, not part of a higher purpose in all of this. And I'm not talking about religious higher purpose, although some people have that. I'm talking about just a sense of what is the reason I'm here. And that can disappear very fast in residency, because you're so overwhelmed and you're like, oh man, there's a rectal in 5 and there's a trauma coming in 6 and, you know, and this stupid, you know, medicine intern won't just take the patient. And, you know, it's melting your brain, like those higher purposes are rapidly washed away. So I used humor as a very negative coping mechanism, and I started winning teaching awards because I did that. So the house staff loved it, because what I would do is I'd build a wall around us using humor. Blame this guy, make fun of the patient, make fun of the other attending, make fun of the consultant, make fun of the emergency department, make fun of the hospitalist. It doesn't matter. It's like Trump, whoever's not there, you just badmouth them. And then when they're in the room, they're your best friend. And so that kind of way of approaching the world was my coping mechanism for a long time as an attending, and it worked great. The problem was I started to feel the soul was gone. And when someone asked me, are you happy doing what you're doing? I had to think about it until I thought about it. And I'm like, no, I'm absolutely not. Like, this is not who I am. This is not what, when I was young, I used humor to break down walls, to put myself at ease in social situations that were awkward, to make people feel better in tense situations. That's what I did in medical school. By the time I was done with residency, I was using it for evil. And so once I recognized that, and it happened midway through my career as an attending, that was actually when I started making videos as my way of reclaiming humor as a way to actually try to affect some degree of positivity. And it took a while to see it actually bear fruit, but that was my, and I think it was subconscious at the time. I felt like I just want to be myself for a change. And myself was using humor for these sort of this vehicle. So that's why it took so long. And then what I found is once I started making the videos and I started thinking more globally about purpose and fulfillment and reading books about philosophy and stuff and trying to get educated on what does it mean to be a human being instead of just it's reductionism, it's atoms and all of this, that's when I would go into a patient's room and get emotional, like finally feel what was going on, right, in a visceral way. And that allowed me to be a much better doctor. Does it allow you to see 40 patients a day? No. So it takes more time. So that's what part of the reason I quit, moved to Vegas, and tried to start a clinic where we had more time with patients to give people the tools to do that. And there's no magic answer. And economically, it's hard. And it's always touch and go. But that was my story.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
I know you were talking about moving out to Vegas and kind of starting all over. I know it seems like one of the main things that leads to physician burnout is just a lot of the frustrations of healthcare. I know you kind of, with Tony Hsieh, had set up this turntable health model, kind of where you personalize how you guys want to develop healthcare. Can you kind of tell us about that and how we can kind of incorporate that into like the emergency medicine aspect of things?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what I find is, you know, emergency medicine docs are probably my closest kindred spirit in terms of personality and sort of aptitude and connection and stuff, which is weird because I became a hospitalist and they are the most boring people in the world. So I just want to give a shout out to the emergency guys. And I'm not just kissing your butts. I say this to hospitalists all the time. I'm like, you guys need to have more fun. So that being said, what we ended up doing is we said, okay, look, when I left Stanford in the Bay Area to come here, I was given sort of a slate to say, okay, I will give you a very small investment where you have to come up with some kind of business that's going to make healthcare better, whatever it is. Maybe you're just making videos, whatever it was. But what I found is the more I started thinking about health policy and the structure of what was wrong, because you know, when you're in the matrix, when you're there plugged into the hospital, it is very hard to see that it's all zeros and ones. It's very hard to see the bigger picture. You're just trying to get through your day. And it's also true that someone told me once, it's very hard to believe. Let's just say this, when your livelihood depends on believing the truths of a system, it is almost impossible to believe a competing truth. And so for the first time when I went to Vegas, I was unplugged from the matrix. I could step back, and also my livelihood now depended on coming up with an alternative to the way I was doing business before, which is fee-for-service medicine in an employed, you know, system. And so what we looked at was we said, well, what's fixed? What's broken? I read The Innovator's Prescription by Clayton Christensen, which is a great book, Harvard Business School guy with a couple of docs, trying to figure out from a business model what's going on with healthcare. And he has some interesting ideas. And then just talking to as many people as I could. And the nice thing about knowing Tony Hsieh is that you have access to all these thought leaders. So you can just call up, you know, whoever and be like, so tell me about, you know, what's going on in health policy. So I got to learn a lot. And in the process, I said, okay, we don't do relationships very well in medicine anymore, because we've gone from this health 1.0 world where it was you and me in the sacred relationship, but it was very paternalistic and it was very unfettered by evidence and by technology. And it was just a doctor and a patient in this thing. Now, as medicine grew, as patients now have access to information through Dr. Google, as business requirements started to say, look, who are these doctors? They're costing a fortune. The quality isn't that good. They get to do whatever they want. They self-police. They bill insurance and insurance pays. This isn't sustainable. So in response to that, we have this health 2.0 system that we're all in now. And that was the system that actually burned me out, because I signed up thinking I was doing my dad's medicine 1.0. And in practice, I was an employed physician in a corporate environment where there were RVUs and click boxes in an EHR. And I was on call the night Epic went live in our institution. And it just went from this sort of write a note that's a narrative about the patient to click a ton of boilerplate boxes. And it's a basically a cut and paste ransom note. And it had devalued the relationship. So now we're commodities. And the model has gone from this sort of patriarchal guild to an assembly line commodity model, where both the patient and the doctors are just going through the motions, giving each other information and then leaving, you know, to the patient to decide. They go to Dr. Google, find out Jenny McCarthy says something that agrees with their intuition. Next thing you know, they're not vaccinating. With Turntable Health, we said, okay, we want to rehumanize medicine. We want to create something called Health 3.0, which takes the sacred relationship from one and brings it back, but it makes it more of a partnership. The doctor still has a lot of information, knowledge, and expertise the patient doesn't have, but the patient does too that the doctor doesn't have, and they work in partnership in an interpretive relationship where he or she knows, has the time and the skills and the training to get her hopes, dreams, and fears figured out, and she holds him accountable to be the shepherd through the care. And in return, they're paid on actual outcomes. Did we improve hypertension? Did we improve depression? Did we get people to lose weight? Did these things actually happen? Did we prevent diabetes? And those are hard metrics to measure, but we need to work on measuring them, because when you're paid to do the right thing, you will figure out ways to do it. And 9 out of 10 times, it involves spending more time like this. Now, so at Turntable Health, we get paid a flat fee per patient, but then we also get a bonus if we actually get outcomes that work. And it's not your typical press gainy patient satisfaction and click this box because you gave them lisinopril for heart failure. No. It's actually outcomes that matter to individual patients. So we work in a team. We take care of each other. We support each other. We listen to each other. When one of us is burned out, we try to figure out why. We're constantly into process improvement. But in the end of the day, it's about spending the time, getting to know the patient, and then giving them the tools and the accountability. So a health coach may text a patient and say, how's that diet going? Or did you pick up the metformin that we were talking about? Or are you coming to the yoga and meditation class that your behavioral health social worker who's on our team is doing? These kind of things that make people feel like they're connected and people are caring about them. So how do you bring that into the emergency department? And when you know you've got a ton of people, first of all, if the emergency department is part of a spectrum, a continuum of care, where it's the engine of primary care is something like us, I'm not saying us particularly, but this kind of team-based, preventative, holistic 3.0 model, if you have that, which by the way, in a 3.0 model, you're evidence empowered, but you're not evidence enslaved. So you don't have to click the box that says mammogram just because, you know, 900 Northern European, you know, women that are Caucasian, it showed like in the mean of the curve, like it helps to do that. No, we actually are looking at that unique Hispanic, 42-year-old woman who has a family history but is worried about false positives. We can actually get to know her. So those gray areas thrive in 3.0. So how does it work for the ER? If you're part of the system, then first of all, you have this beautiful, seamless communication with the outpatient world, because that's missing so much when you see a patient hit the door. First of all, you can't even get records because the EHRs don't talk to each other. And then you try to call the PCP and they don't have the time or the incentive to care. Like, just, I send them there because I want you to figure it out, right? Or the patient doesn't have a PCP. And then when you guys are working with each other, it's usually a siloed off kind of thing where you're doing your thing and the nurse is doing her thing and then the consultant's coming down. It's an adversarial relationship. So changing that, first of all, so that everyone's skin is in the game of just doing the right thing for the patient. I've heard so many emergency department docs say, I wish when I call a consultant that people would just do the right thing for the patient. That works great if everybody's skin is in that game. Like, we're just trying to get the right outcome for the patient, then everyone does better financially, ethically, morally, emotionally, right? And so aligning those incentives. So you have to go into your emergency department and go, how can we structure teams? How can we work on workflow? How can we be paid and incentivized differently? And how can we collaborate with these sort of 3.0 sort of little colonies that are growing up to actually provide better seamless care for our patients? How can we work with community paramedicine to actually prevent people from going into the ER? And then how can we work with our frequent flyers and actually target them specifically and say, if we were actually focusing on you and why it is you keep coming back, right, whether it's economic or social determinants of health, something else going on, we could actually change throughput in the ER, get better outcomes, and do the humane thing for the patient. So there's no magic answer. It's complicated, but those are the principles that we try to put in place when we're talking about how do you make this better in the emergency department?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that was super insightful. I completely agree. I think a lot of the times, you know, as providers, we think it's a very paternalistic approach. You know best, we studied medicine, let me tell you what's wrong with you, and you listen to me. So I think it's really important for us to also take a step back and remember, you know, this should be kind of a two-step approach, and we should also, you know, listen to what they have to say and kind of incorporate them into how they want to carry out their own, you know, healthcare, because we just keep telling them they're not going to always listen to us. We don't always know best.
I mean, I see however many docs here on the bottom of my panel, and they're all just going, yeah, try convincing a patient to do what's best for them using the tools that we have. And it's just hard. And I think part of what you touched on is that humans are emotional and intuitive creatures, and reason, the lately evolved neocortex that's barely a blip geologically and evolutionarily speaking, didn't evolve to actually run the show. It evolved to be an arbiter, a lawyer, a press agent, a spokesman for the intuitive, unconscious, primitive brain. So when you come in and a person, you're wondering why the hell they keep coming back to the emergency department, and they're diabetic and they keep eating crap and they're not taking their insulin or whatever it is, and they're showing up in DKA, and you're talking, your little conscious part is trying to reason with their conscious part, but what's running the show is this elephant that is their intuition and emotion and the reason, the real reasons they're behaving they are. Until you get into that elephant's head and you change the path that elephant is walking on, because there's a little rider on top of the elephant, conscious brain, unconscious emotion, and intuition. This elephant isn't dumb. It actually has an intelligence of its own. Until you get into its head and change the path that it's walking on and you direct that little rider simply and effectively, no behavior is going to change. If anything, they're going to entrench. Look at politics. It's the same thing. If you're Republican, if you're Democrat, when you hear the opposing view, you get this emotional, affective burst of disgust, and then you immediately start spinning reasons that that person is wrong. Instead of stopping, listening, feeling the other side, feeling what they might feel about it, where they're coming from. And the same comes with our patients. Why are they behaving the way they do? You don't have a lot of time in the emergency department. So if we had training, if we had better systems, processes, if we had better incentives to do the right thing, then I think we could start to chip away at that psychology, but it's going to take a lot of work because what we're doing now does not work.
This has been some intense discussion. I really like it. Obviously, we don't want to take up too much of your time. We really appreciate you being here, but a couple other quick questions. A lot of your videos seem to pertain towards wellness topics, whether it's burnout, the most recent one with kind of the hippie medicine being both beneficial and difficult to deal with, opioid abuse. Where do you get your inspiration for this? Is this just like one of your things, or is it fed to you? Like, how do you get this?
Weird Al once, who's my idol, by the way, once said that, you know, he gets like 1,000 letters a day asking him to do different parodies. And he's just like, dude, I have so many parodies in my head already that it's impossible to even get through those, let alone these ideas. So for me, what happens is something will pop up like a topic. It depends. So sometimes there'll be a song I'll hear like, you know, the Weeknd, Can't Feel My Face. It writes itself. It's about stroke, right? He can't feel his face, you know. And so then I think, oh, what's the simplest solution to this problem? You know, I can't feel my face. My tongue won't move. Am I stroking? Oh, and it just starts to write. And then I come up with a spreadsheet. I take the original lyrics, the new lyrics. I'll make a bullet list of points I want to get across from the educational stay. And then we go with it. Sometimes someone just throws me an idea. Oh, you know, it's beginning to look a lot like sepsis, for example. An emergency department doctor on Twitter tweeted that at me. Oh, that would be funny if Z-Dog did that. And I looked at the tweet and I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant. Like, why didn't I'm an idiot. And then I go back to the song and I go, this is it, you know. It's beginning to look a lot like sepsis when the BP's low. Heart is racing and brain is dim. Send a lactate on ice and then play central lines. Cassandra's dying without Van Coe. You get the idea. So the idea was then that little spark of idea from a doctor then triggers me to go and do the work and then make it happen. And so it's all these different inspirations. And the truth is a lot of it just comes from 10 years of being on the wards, like living the life and then spitting it out. That's why I think it's very hard to do something like this unless you've been in the trenches, you're part of the tribe of medicine, and you do it. And even though I've cut a lot of my clinical hours out now, that experience has allowed me now to be a little more of a voice for the people in the trenches that are suffering. So there's, you know, there's the patient PSAs, but there's also the stuff that's satirical about healthcare, where we're trying to make a difference in how we behave in the healthcare system. So hopefully I need as much help as I can get. That's what I'm saying. Help me.
Can I just say that you totally made my whole week, because I was hoping Z-Dog would sing to us. Ideally, a little bit of rapping, but and it's got some seasonal relevance to it. It's just A+. But, you know, the thing that resonates with me the most, Z-Dog, is, first of all, thanks for so much for doing this. And I don't say too often that people are inspirational, but this is truly inspirational what you're doing from a healthcare standpoint. But not only that, you know, a lot of what we do in the emergency department, we just stick a Band-Aid on it. We fix what is already way past broken. And it's really not the right way to do things, right? You kind of have to step back, at least in my educational realm and this wellness, trying to fix the wellness realm, is maybe we should step back, not just saying, hey, we should host a little party that day, or we should have liver rounds. Like, going back, and should we potentially try to blow up everything that we know about education and think about, if we had to do it all over, how would we design something that actually fits how the millennials think, how they work, all the psychosocial dynamics of becoming a physician. And so, you know, you bring a lot of very cool, interesting insights into what, you know, we could potentially do in the future, at least in the education realm. So thanks for doing this.
I mean, Michelle, if anyone's going to actually make it happen, if anyone is going to make it happen, it's going to be you, because you think about this stuff, you care about it. And so it's going to take that kind of thinking to change things. And I'm glad you're working on it, because I'll tell you otherwise, it's game
no,
over.
Not me.
Yeah, you. You, I'm looking at you.
Damn it.
No, it's you. And you know, the thing is, I think the idea about fun is a crucial piece that's missing from healthcare all over the place. That's, look, guys, listen to me carefully right now. I go around the country speaking, performing, doing stuff, talking about health 3.0, the kind of stuff we're talking about now. People come away and they're like, that was the best talk I've ever seen. And then I realize why that is. It's not because I'm good. It's because the bar for having fun at a talk in healthcare is, it's microscopic, it's in the ground. You just have to show up. And so that is appalling to me, that we should all be stepping up and having fun and doing as much as we can. Because, you know, the people, you guys remember your class plays in medical school, and I mean, those were funny as hell, right? And then that gets beaten out of us. So let's bring some of that fun back and just change the dynamic totally. Or it gets you arrested. Either way, it's interesting.
Again, thank you so much for doing this. Do you have any other last minute things you want to bring up about wellness, or maybe your personal wellness goals or something like that you want to kind of close us out with?
Yeah, one thing I'm going to say, okay, look, I'm a pretty skeptical dude. I'm a science-based guy. I love to harsh on anti-vaxxers. I will take a crap on pseudoscience any day of the week. This meditation thing is legit. And I'm just going to say this because it took me leaving my type A job and moving to the desert, where it's a blank slate and there's this weird stark emptiness, to discover this thing, like, oh, wait a minute. Like, all this noise in my head is not actually who I am. Who I am is the awareness in which all this noise arises. And the minute you realize that, in any situation, you can be in the middle of a trauma and feces is flying everywhere and, you know, there's a Foley in your face. And, you know, I'm just saying, I like, this stuff's going crazy. You can step back in your mind and be the witness of everything in a non-judgmental, open, and calm way that will refocus you, especially in the emergency department where it's just chaos. And if you get caught up in your monkey mind, it's very hard to get your job done. So practice this. It's the simplest thing. There's nutrition and diet we can talk about another time. But if you just spend even just 5 minutes, read about the theory behind it, read some books about it, because what it'll do is it'll frame your thinking when you do it where it makes more sense. It's not just you sitting there focusing on your breath. Why would you do that? Like, who cares about your breath, right? Well, the idea is that you're training your attention to focus on an object of awareness. And if you do that enough, you start to notice the awareness itself is independent of any object, and that leads to total liberation and freedom. The Buddhists have been saying this forever. I'm an atheist, and yet I'm telling you, for the first time I felt as connected as I've ever felt to the nature of everything through meditation. And again, this isn't like some weird Deepak Chopra. Buy my special meditation glasses, and very quickly, you only will feel very good about yourself. No, none of that. I'm just saying, just try it out. And millennials are innately better at this, I found. They're like savants at meditation. So keep it up, keep working. It's a practice for a reason.
Thank you so much for the great thought-provoking information, ideas, concepts we've talked about tonight. And hopefully this will help us all here, as well as the people listening and watching live and then future on the podcast, increase our wellness and become better physicians and people.
You guys are on point. I love it. Thank you. It's such an honor, you guys.
And that wraps up a great episode from the Wellness Think Tank. Special thanks to our exclusive sponsors, US Acute Care Solutions. You can reach us also on Twitter at WellnessTT. Until next time, remember that residency training should be about thriving and not just surviving.